We're beginning this morning a study of the book of James, and James is unique in a lot of ways. And when you look at the books of the New Testament, it's extremely practical, very much focused in on wise, practical instruction for daily living as a Christian. In many ways, it reminds people of the Old Testament book of Proverbs, or one of the wisdom literature books. But the book of James is approaching practical living from that Christian point of view. Just a lot of different themes, a lot of different topics that are discussed in James. And it's tremendously relevant, just tremendously so. Not a lot of high, heavy, esoteric kind of themes. Not a lot of theological principles, maybe like you see Paul addressing in his letters. James is much more practical, addressing very, very day-to-day problems. It's really, really rich. And so I'm looking forward to our study of James. It begins, and I want to spend this class, as I typically would, looking at some introductory things. Let's introduce ourselves to this book. Always important, I think, that we do that. Here's how the letter begins. James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. Greetings. And so the author identifies himself and identifies the recipients of this letter. And I want to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk about the individual James in our class on Wednesday night. I think there's a lot of things about him that we need to address and take a whole class to address. But let's just go ahead and this morning, real quickly, talk about this question. Who is the James that is being identified here as the author of the book? Sometimes people ask, well, could this be James, the son of Zebedee, one of the 12 apostles, one of those leading apostles in Jesus' close association, Peter, James, and John. You read about that. Probably not. You will recall that he died very early. He was martyred very early by Herod Antipas, or Herod Agrippa, rather. And probably right about AD 44, Acts 12 talks about that. Even though I do think the letter of James is a very early letter, we'll talk more about that in a second, I think that's a little bit too early for James, the son of Zebedee, to be the James under discussion. There are some people who have suggested and still try to argue that it's James, the son of Alphaeus, one of the apostles, James the Less, as he is referred to. Mark 15, verse 40 mentions him. And in fact, that's a common Roman Catholic view. Sorry about the typo there. A common Roman Catholic view. Why do you think maybe that Roman Catholicism would really want to have that be the James who was the author of this epistle?
The other James that will be leading to the James, the brother of Jesus, and they want a very version.
Exactly right. Because really the standard view, the view that I think is correct, I don't think there really is much doubt about this, or should be much doubt about this. That standard view is objectionable to Roman Catholic theology, because the most likely individual being referred to as James here is James, the brother of the Lord, or half-brother of the Lord, who was a key figure in the Jerusalem church. He's referred to Acts 12, Acts 15, Acts 21. One of those brothers of Jesus, Joseph and Mary, had other sons and daughters after Mary gave birth to Jesus. And that really goes against this Roman Catholic idea of the perpetual virginity of Mary. And so that's especially why a lot of Roman Catholics over the years have tried to argue that James, the son of Alphaeus, is the James who wrote this letter. I don't believe that's correct. The author identifies himself simply as James, as if that is quite sufficient. It's interesting. All throughout the book of Acts, whenever the brother of the Lord is mentioned, he's always just referred to as James. And the other Jameses that are referred to. They're always identified. James, the son of Zebedee. James, son of Alphaeus. Some other kind of demarcation. Always to distinguish them from James. And what we need to really appreciate, and what I'm going to talk about more on Wednesday night, is what a key figure James, the brother of the Lord, became in that Jerusalem church. Among those Jewish Christians. You know, if you think of the Apostle Paul as being an apostle, especially called by the Lord, as an apostle to the Gentiles, well, James, the brother of the Lord, is sort of a special apostolic type figure. You know, maybe not an apostle, but, you know, virtually on the same level of authority for Jewish Christians. And I don't want us to give him short shrift, and so that's why we're going to take some time next class to really talk about him. But I'm just saying all this as we begin this morning. I think, as we'll even see further, there's no question that this James, the brother of the Lord, is the author of this epistle. And so that's how we're going to be approaching that as we go throughout our class. Comments about anything I've said? Just wanted to kind of hurriedly go over some of this beginning stuff. Anything? Mickey?
What do they say about the brothers, siblings of Jesus?
Oh, that maybe they were Joseph's children from another marriage, you know, before he married Mary. You know, you could hypothesize that. Is there any evidence for that? No, but, you know, you just kind of pull that out of thin air. But, you know, yeah. Okay. Now we're kind of getting to some things here that I think really are crucial as we begin to approach this letter of James. Who was it written to? Who are the recipients of this letter? And again, if you just look at how it's introduced, James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12... Whoops. Well, if I can get it right here. Get my thing working. All right. To the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. To the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. First of all, that expression, 12 tribes, would suggest what? What's that nomenclature pointing to? All right, Jews. All right, that's the typical way that Jews would refer to those who are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I mean, that's that standard terminology. I am very much aware of the fact that Peter, in 1 Peter, he uses similar language to speak about Jewish and Gentile Christians, but he's making a purposeful play off of that because he's emphasizing that these Gentiles have been grafted in, to use Paul's language. They are now among the seed of Abraham. But this was typical language that was used to refer to Jews, and his expression, those who are dispersed abroad, or some of your versions may say scattered, okay? What is that referring to, or what did ancient Jews use that kind of terminology to designate? Okay, those Jews who were not living in Palestine, just Jerusalem, but those who were not living in Palestine, not living in the Promised Land, but were dispersed, but were scattered. In fact, that terminology originates back with what Old Testament event? All right, the Babylonian captivity, where the Jews were then taken away into Babylonian exile. And so they were then scattered around the nations of the world. And even after Babylon falls and the Medo-Persians take over and then the Greeks and then finally the Romans, you still have massive numbers of Jews who remain scattered abroad, dispersed. The Greek word for dispersed is diaspora, which just means scattered. But that's where we get this term. You may have heard this term. I've used this term. It's sort of a standard way of referring to them. The diaspora Jews. Diaspora Jews are those Jews who are not living in Palestine, but are living scattered throughout the Greco-Roman world. And that's how they were commonly referred to. And so James now uses this terminology as he is writing then to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. Now, even here, though, I think we need to appreciate he's using this terminology in a more narrow qualified sense, because is he writing, do you think, to all the biological Jews who were scattered throughout the Greco-Roman Empire, or specifically what dispersed Jews is he talking about? Yeah, those who have become disciples of Jesus Christ. And so if you appreciate that point, it's very obvious as you read the letter that he's writing to then Jews who are Christians, okay? Not Jews in general, not unbelieving Jews, but he's using the terminology that unbelieving Jews in general would use to refer to Jews in general. He's using that same terminology, but yet the usage of it is being limited to those who are Christians. Which suggests what about who real Israel is? Who is Israel, God's nation? It's those who are followers of King Jesus. I mean, that's the implicit point there. So I want us to see that. So having said all that, it's this is a letter that I think clearly is written to Jewish Christians. The content suggests a Jewish audience. When you look at it, look at the content of this letter, there are just several things in it that suggest that the author is writing to Jewish Christians, not Gentile Christians, Jewish Christians. He uses Jewish terminology, some of which we've already talked about, chapter 2, verse 2, his reference to the assembly, when someone comes into your assembly. It's the Greek word synagoge, synagogue. Okay? It's a very Jewish term. Okay, and all that just kind of is mounting evidence that you're talking about a totally Jewish audience. To me, the thing that just nails it down in my judgment, there's no reference anywhere in the letter whatsoever to Gentiles, to Jew-Gentile issues. When you read the book of Acts, or when you read Paul's letters to churches that were made up of Jews and Gentiles, were there ever any occasions that Paul had to address Jew-Gentile issues? How about in every letter? Some of them extensively, like that's the main reason why he's writing it, but at least there's some reference to it, at least some reference to the fact that you've got Gentile believers and Jewish believers now in the same congregation. Paul talks about that all the time. There are issues, there are struggles. He at least makes some reference to that. That's not what you see in James. There's no reference at all. And that is what kind of makes this, in my judgment, it just, and I think most people, this really isn't some disputed point, that when you talk about the recipients of this letter, you're talking about Christians who are Jews. A group of Christians who are Jews, and the fact that he would speak of them as scattered, as dispersed, would suggest that they're not living where? Not living in, not just Jerusalem, but not living in Palestine. In fact, what's another little argument that would indicate that is the language that this was originally written in. What language was the book of James originally written in? No? Greek. Greek. Which is the language that Jews dispersed throughout the Greco-Roman Empire that they would speak, no matter what their local dialect was. Greek being that standard language throughout the Greco-Roman world. If this were a letter written to Jews living in Palestine, you would expect it to be written in what language? Aramaic, which is a form of Hebrew. Yeah. So without question, the original language is Greek. So again, what we're trying to do is just get an idea. Who was this written to? And that helps understand, you know, why it was written. So I think these are important questions. And it was written to Jewish Christians outside of Palestine who were dispersed, who were scattered outside of Palestine. Comment or question about that? Dave.
When you consider the situation with really two cultures, the Greek culture, Gentile culture and the Jewish culture, that have now come together, the only way to direct something to the Jews specifically, a Jewish Christian, was to identify them as a scattered, as those that had been scattered abroad, and to separate that idea. But I think it's ironic that he would do that, and he had to, when Jesus, the mystery was we would bring them all together. They would be as one, the right. Jew and the Gentile. But to identify them physically, he had to use that word scatter, dispersed.
Right, and in fact, you're kind of raising something that relates to what I want to talk about now, because I want to talk about kind of the historical events that kind of led to all of this. But I'll just say this without stealing my own thunder. What you're pointing out, you know, why would he have addressed this letter strictly to Jews and ignore Gentile Christians? What's maybe one explanation for that? Maybe not ignoring Gentile Christians, but maybe the letter was written when? Before Gentiles began to become converts to Jesus. So I want to talk about this. Open up your Bibles to Acts chapter 8. Recall, Acts chapter 8 talks about that persecution that Saul of Tarsus, prior to his conversion, was instrumental in. Persecution against those who were Christians, that is, the unbelieving Jews, persecuting Jews who had accepted Jesus as the Messiah. And so chapter 7 had talked about the martyrdom of Stephen. And so chapter 8 starts, and Saul was in hearty agreement with putting him, that is Stephen, to death. And on that day, a great persecution arose against the church in Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. And some devout men buried Stephen, made loud lamentation over him. But Saul began ravaging the church, entering house after house and dragging off men and women. He would put them in prison. And, of course, it goes on then to talk about that. I'm wanting to refresh your memories about this, that when Christianity began, it began in Jerusalem. And in those earliest years, the only Christians, of course, were Jews. And they were centered in Jerusalem, and the apostles are teaching them, and the numbers are growing, it's just burgeoning, and just tremendous numbers. And then you have this issue of the Jewish leaders then persecuting them. And you will remember Acts chapter 5 talked about how Gamaliel on the Sanhedrin Council had said, don't make martyrs out of those apostles. It'll just backfire. And if it were from God, you don't want to go against God. But it's going to backfire if you make martyrs out of the apostles. So they let the apostles alone, but they persecuted anybody who would convert to the apostles' teaching. And instead of quelling Christianity, it just, these new converts weren't afraid. And they were persecuted, yes. They were scattered, yes. They ran from Jerusalem, yes, because they were trying to escape persecution. But did they give up their belief in Jesus as the Messiah? Absolutely not. So all it did was take these thousands of Jewish Christians who had been staying there in Jerusalem, learning the apostles' teaching, it just scattered them throughout Judea and then further into the Gentile areas, and the gospel then just spreads to more and more and more Jews in the various synagogues and all those Jewish communities. Still isn't going to the Gentiles yet. And that's what happened initially. Now, as you keep going in the book of Acts, like over in Acts chapter 10 and then 11, what you begin to see is that those who are Jews who've been scattered, as the years go by, they start preaching the gospel to whom? Even to Gentiles. And of course, it all starts with Peter in Acts 10 and 11. Luke talks about Peter first preaching the gospel to the household of Cornelius. But even after that, in various quarters where these Jewish Christians have been scattered, you know, they're living in Gentile cities. You have a Jewish quarter in a Gentile city, but it's still a Gentile city. And so they start talking to their Gentile friends and neighbors. And so the gospel gradually, over the years, starts spreading to more and more Gentiles. And eventually, let me just say this. Eventually, by the time you get to Acts 15, you've got such a notable number of Gentiles who have been converted to Jesus Christ that these issues about, well, do the Gentiles, if they become Christians, do they have to be circumcised, become Jews? Don't they? And those issues really start coming to the fore. And keep in mind, all this takes time because this isn't the modern day. You don't have communication like we have now. So all these things take place gradually. But gradually you have such numbers of Gentiles that now you start having issues like, well, don't the Gentiles have to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses to be saved? And that's what Acts 15 is talking about in the Jerusalem conference, about all of that. And that takes place in AD 49. Okay? So think about this time frame. From the year Jesus was crucified and the gospel is first preached on that Pentecost day, which would be about year what? AD 30, maybe 33, maybe as late as 33, but right around AD 30. Take it all the way to AD 49, when now you've got Gentiles in pretty massive numbers that have kind of, you know, made a big splash among the Jewish Christians and issues, you know. Okay, those years from AD 30 to AD 49, and really Gentiles even just starting to have the gospel preached to them, you know, in the late 40s, okay. That's this early period as the church is growing, and it's growing as a initially totally Jewish community, totally Jewish Christian. But then only toward the end of those years did Gentiles start having the gospel preached in. But then once it was preached to Gentiles, it was like an explosion. Okay? So that's kind of what has happened. And you will recall in Acts chapter 11, it talks about how the gospel ultimately spreads even as far as Antioch in Syria, which is the third largest city in the Roman Empire at that time. And so this is where ultimately in Antioch of Syria, Saul, who would become Paul, once he is converted and Barnabas brings him there to Antioch, they start teaching Jews and Gentiles. Okay? So that's those later years of the 40s decade of the first century. But that's how the gospel is spreading all throughout this area. And so the question that we want to deal with is, Okay, when was this letter written? And I would suggest to you that even though we can't know for sure about this, I would suggest to you that this was written very early, one of the earliest of the New Testament letters. We know, first of all, when James died. We know precisely the year. He died in A.D. 62, because Josephus talks about his death. I'm going to talk more about that Wednesday night. But this epistle was probably written much, much earlier. As I said, there are no references to Gentile issues. It was probably written even earlier than A.D. 49, even earlier than Acts 15, even earlier than the Jerusalem Council of Acts 15. Probably the reason why there's no reference to Gentile issues at all is because the gospel had not yet spread to Gentiles when James is writing, or else it was just starting. So it really hadn't yet had the numbers of Gentile converts to where James is even addressing that issue. In other words, it's very, very early. Most people agree with that. I mean, it's probably very, very early. In fact, that would make it the earliest of the New Testament books. And I think that's probably true. I think James was probably written A.D. 45, somewhere in there, before the gospel really began to spread to Gentiles. And so James is able to write to Jewish Christians, because the only Christians really at that time were Jews, Jewish Christians scattered throughout, and so that's why he's not addressing any of these Gentile issues. Question or comment about that? Okay.
Mark,
yeah.
You covered it pretty well, but I wanted to mention that I have a note in my New Testament on Acts 8 and this, that this occurred to me as the death occurred about 10 years after Pentecost.
As we would estimate. Well, but yet what's curious about that, Dave, is that James never mentions any of those issues. Never mentions the issue of the law of Moses and its connection with a Jew. Are you saved by the law of Moses? Are we saved by faith in Jesus? Never addresses that. So I don't think that had become an issue yet. I don't think James is written late enough to where those kinds of issues that really only came to the forefront once Gentiles are brought into the picture. That's the reason why I think James just written that early. And so the reason why I emphasize that is just for this reason. There's a tendency, I think, among us, because we're so used to looking at the book of Acts from the end of it, and we see the overall picture of what happens once Gentiles are brought in, that when we think about Jews and all that, and the gospel being preached to Jewish Christians or Christians in the Greco-Roman world, we immediately think of Jew-Gentile issues. And I think if you try to read the book of James with that as the background, you're going to struggle with it, because it's not talking about any of those issues. So that's the reason why I emphasize that. Let me get to Johnny first and then... Oh, I thought you were saying, okay. Dwayne?
I had a discussion last week with a fellow that basically it boiled down to two beliefs, and one saved, the other saved. His explanation was that once his life is, or his name is written in the book of life, he can't ever be lost. So I took him to the end of James where it talks about covering a multitude of sins by
Not reading the text. I know he didn't get that idea from the text. I don't see any way you could read the text and think that it was written to people who were not Christians. That doesn't make a lot of sense. No. Yeah. But okay, let me just say this. I think what allows someone to think that is the very problem I was just talking about. If you're so expecting to read the kind of things that Paul writes about, as Paul's writing to churches that are Jew and Gentile, well then, yeah, James, it's very Jewish. I mean, it's very clear the audience is Jewish. Now, it's Christian Jews, but it's a totally Jewish letter addressing Jewish Christian issues. So that may kind of help explain why. We'll get into that. Yeah. But yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Now, I want to really now talk about just the nature of this letter. And let me just say, first of all, what's the assignment for everybody for Wednesday night? See? You're all from college, but we still have college assignments here. Got to read. This is your assignment. Read the book of James all the way through. As you read it all the way through, are you supposed to stop and look at your marginal references and notes and flip back and forth? And if you're reminded of something, oh, he said faith, so let me look at what Paul said about faith. And are you supposed to do all that? No. And why are you not supposed to do all that? Because whoever these Jewish Christians were, when they first got this letter, James expected them to read it all the way through and not get some other letters and kind of intermix them in there and read them all at the same time. In other words, read it the way you would read any letter. Read it the way it was obviously intended to be read. And so just read it all the way through, and it will take you how long to do that? As we demarcate it, it's 5 chapters. How long will it take you to read that? 15 minutes? Maybe. I mean, maybe not even that. I'm not saying speed read it. I mean, you know, but just nice, normal pace. And get the big picture. And if you're really good students and want an A in the course, I just said that for Ashley's benefit, before Wednesday night, read it all the way through again. Just reread it all the way through. I promise you, that'll just help you. That will help you tremendously. And then as we go through the book and look at the various topics that James discusses, you'll be looking at those topics, those individual topics, but in light of the broader discussion. And let me address this now. When you look at the book of James, as you're reading it through in one sitting, per your assignment, you'll notice that there's a lot of different topics. He talks about trials and difficulties that you're going through. There's discussion about wisdom from above. There's discussion about riches and rich people and your attitude toward wealth. He talks about your relations with other people and right and wrong ways to interact with other people. He talks about how faith should be an active faith, something that you really live. And he talks about your speech and the way you use your tongue. Just a lot of different topics that really are different topics, but as I have so effectively, John, in my illustration here, with the circles, the Venn diagram where they intersect just a little bit, these topics do relate to one another. So, you know, it isn't like that it's a collection of disparate topics that have no connection with each other. No, they certainly have a connection. But what you see is that the book of James is just a discussion of all these different kinds of topics, and others too, that, you know, I could have put on the chart. And now I want us to talk just a moment about how he addresses these topics. Just the way, the style of writing that he uses to address these topics. It's quite different from any other New Testament book. Quite different. For example, remember 1 Corinthians, okay? 1 Corinthians, in the first six chapters, Paul addresses various topics that he has learned about, problems going on in Corinth from oral reports, from Chloe's people, from those there, about various issues, various major problems in Corinth. And he talks about each of these problems in turn. Divisions, chapters 1 through 4. Chapter 5, incest in the church. Chapter 6, lawsuits and fornication. He addresses each of those topics one by one, then moves on to the next topic. Starting in chapter 7, he responds to questions they asked in their letter. And just various issues. Chapter 7, he talks about celibacy, and then virgins, and then chapters 8 through 10, meat used in idolatrous sacrifices, and just one topic after another. And that's the way that if we in our culture were writing a letter or doing a paper, you know, submitting a paper for your teacher at school or your boss, a report or something, isn't that how we would write? You know, okay, I'm going to address various topics, and I discuss that, move on to the next one, then the next one, and, you know, and then maybe at the end we might give a little summary of what we talked about, but that's a Western linear way to structure something. Address the topic, move on to a different one, then a different one, then a different one, and then end it. Okay, that's not the way that ancient Jews thought. Have you ever read the book of Proverbs? How is the book of Proverbs arranged? Are all of the Proverbs talking about speech? Are they all found in, you know, chapter 1? And then all the Proverbs that talk about marriage, they're in chapter 2. And then we move on. Is that how it's arranged? No, when you read the book of Proverbs, what you see is that there are just hundreds of topics, and they're all just interspersed. And so you might be reading a proverb here in chapter 10 about a nagging wife. And then it's followed by then a proverb talking about a husband being faithful to his wife. Then a proverb talking about business ethics. And it, you know, just moves around. That's the way that the book of James is structured. He starts out talking about trials, and then he makes some comments about wisdom, and he makes some comments about riches, and makes some comments about your relationship with others, and then he talks about wisdom again, and then he talks about your speech, and then he talks about relationship with others again. And then he goes back to talk about wisdom again. And then he says something about your faith, having to be active faith. And then after that, then he'll say something about another topic maybe he already had mentioned, but yet here's something else about that. So this is why people in our culture, very often, they read that, and, you know, very logical people, you know, don't like it, because, you know, I want everything in a nice little package, every subject dealt with individually, you know. That's not the way James writes. I tell you what it reminds me of. It reminds me of the book of Proverbs. It reminds me of the way parents talk to their children when they're lecturing them. Where, I mean, there are like several different themes and worries you have, you know, about who your companions are and what time you're going to, where you're going to go, and all this. So you have all these different issues, and do you address all those in a nice linear fashion? No. You'll talk about your curfew, and then you'll talk about the people you're with. And let me go back to that curfew business again. Because you need to, you know, and then you talk about, you know, the kind of things you're doing for entertainment. And then let me get back to those companions you have. I'm going to say something else about that I just thought of. And then you start addressing that. And it's about that time that your kids' eyes roll back, you know. But that's the way that you talk to your kids. That's also the way that ancient Jewish writers talked about wisdom. Just wisdom literature is kind of that way. There are other ancient Jewish wisdom writings that just kind of jumps back and forth throughout various themes. And so as you read through the book of James, I want you just to observe that. Now, in times past, when I have taught the book of James, I have actually done this. I haven't taken the class through it verse after verse after verse. I would take out all the portions talking about, say, speech. And we talk about, you know, just in one, you know, like a few classes, and then almost as if it were the book of Proverbs. The only problem with doing that I've seen is that people then, though, do miss that James does speak about these things in the order he does for a reason. It's not just totally a hodgepodge or, you know, without any rhyme or reason. And so I do think you missed the flow of it. So I don't want us to do that. We are going to go through the text in sections, but I want you to be aware, though, that we're going to be noting that when we get, say, to chapter 3 and he talks about this subject right here, okay, he already had talked earlier about that same subject. And so you need to kind of keep that in mind. So this is the reason why when you're dealing with James, especially, you've got to be reading it all the way through and rereading it on a regular basis to keep the big picture in your mind. Okay? So, does that make some sense? This is why the book of James, studying it, is a little bit different than, say, studying 1 Corinthians. Okay? Does that make some sense? All right. Questions or comments about any of that? Nancy?
Since Paul wrote Corinthians in 57, is it just because 55, yeah, the style changed by that
point? No. Okay. Nancy asked the question, why would James be written in this style, say, so different from the style Paul uses? Think about the nature of those letters. Paul's writing to largely Gentile audiences, and he addresses them the way that a Gentile would address Gentiles, with that way of writing and framing the issues. James, though, is writing to Jewish Christians, and so he addresses them as Jews. Very similar to what they would have heard or how things would have been discussed in Jewish synagogues all their life. Now, he's, again, as a Christian, talking about all these subjects, but very similar to that. Does that make sense? Tommy? Because another thing that a good Jewish synagogue speaker, when he was through, he'd shut up, unlike some of the preachers we have today. I'll tell you what, keep talking. When the bell goes off, they keep talking. That's a good question. He does end this letter rather abruptly. He was through. Like Forrest Gump, that's all I've got to say about that.